345 BCE, origins of the words mint and money. In the center of Rome, a temple was built, dedicated to goddess Juno Moneta. Juno was the goddess of protection, and Moneta is derived from the Latin monere, which means to warn or advise. It is said that goddess Juno gave warnings or advice on at least a couple of occasions. First, when the Gauls sacked Rome in 390 BCE, Juno's sacred geese gave Roman commander Marcus Manlius Capitolinus a heads up that the Gauls were coming, allowing him to protect the capital. Second, during an earthquake when a voice from the temple advised the Romans to sacrifice a pregnant sow. From 269 BCE, the Roman mint was located at this temple and lasted some centuries. The English words, mint, and money are derived from Juno Moneta. 336 to 323 BCE, gold to silver peg. Alexander the Great simplified the silver to gold exchange rate by declaring a fixed exchange rate of 10 units of silver equal to 1 unit of gold. This peg eventually failed. The Americans effectively tried the same thing in the 18th century at rates of 15 to 1 and 16 to 1. Later, we'll discuss what currency pegs are, how they are managed, and how difficult they are to maintain. This is relevant today because there are a number of attempts to create a stable coin cryptocurrency, some of which rely on an entity or automated smart contract to defend a peg by buying when the price is too low and selling when the price is too high. 323 to 330 BCE, warehouse receipts, representative money. Ptolemy, a Greek bodyguard of Alexander the Great, established himself as ruler of Egypt. He created a dynasty which ruled Egypt until the demise of Cleopatra with the Roman conquest of 30 BCE. The Ptolemies, as the rulers were known, established a system of warehouse accounts where debts could be repaid by transferring the title to grain from one owner to another without physically moving the grain stored within. 118 BCE, leather banknotes. Square white deerskin leather with colorful borders was used as money in China. This is possibly the first documented type of banknote. China would later experiment with paper-based banknotes, then stop using them for a few hundred years before reintroducing them. 30 BCE to 14 CE, tax reform. Augustus Caesar, adopted son of Julius Caesar, expanded Rome's taxation of the provinces, regularizing tax levies which, until then, had been decentralized to the provinces. He introduced sales, land, and poll taxes. These taxes weren't universally unpopular, especially in the provinces, where taxes until then had been somewhat arbitrary. If you hate paying taxes, you probably hate paying arbitrary taxes at arbitrary frequencies even more. Augustus Caesar also issued new, almost pure, gold, silver, brass, and copper coins. To 270 CE, debasement and inflation. Over the next 300 years, the silver content of Roman coins fell from 100% to 4%. Talk about debasement. But as we saw earlier, the U.S. dollar has fallen in value by 96% in a third of the time. Attempts by leaders such as Emperor Aurelian to purify coinage failed, as Gresham's Law kicked in and people circulated their debased coins and hoarded the pure ones. 306 to 337 CE, gold for the rich, debased coins for the poor. Constantine, the first Christian Roman emperor, issued a new gold coin, the solidus, which was used successfully and without debasement for the next 700 years. That is quite some achievement. However, he also produced debased silver and copper coins. So, the rich got to use nice shiny gold coins that retained value, where the poor got coins that steadily decreased in value. Is that surprising? Circa 435 CE, No more coins for Brits for 200 years. Anglo-Saxons invaded Britain, and coins were no longer used as money for 200 years. Money, it turns out, can come in and out of fashion, depending on the politics at the time. Just because we grow up with one form of money, it doesn't mean it will last forever. 806 to 821 CE, fiat money in China. Due to a shortage of copper, Chinese Emperor Hien Sung issued paper money notes for merchants who wanted to make large payments without the inconvenience of heavy coins. Over the next few hundred years, there was much overprinting and inflation, causing paper money to depreciate against metals. This is a theme we hear over and over again. Paper money spread to Europe via Marco Polo, a Venetian who traveled extensively and learnt of paper money from his travels in China from 1275 to 1292. Paper money was only used in China for a few hundred years, during which time inflation soared due to uncontrolled printing of paper money. In the 1400s, they seem to have stopped using paper money for a few hundred years. 1300s. British pennies shrink twice. In 1344 and 1351, on two separate occasions, King Edward III reduced the size and quality of the penny. The king owned the mint, so a smaller and less fine penny meant that the king could issue more pennies from the same amount of metal, meaning more profits or seigniorage for the king. The debasement of all forms of money that is not commodity money seems to be a common theme in the history of money. 1560, Gresham's Law. Another year, another currency reform. This time, Queen Elizabeth I recalled and melted coins, separating the base metals from the precious metals. Thomas Gresham became an advisor to the Queen and noticed that bad money drives out good. 1600s, the rise of the goldsmiths. Goldsmiths in Britain became bankers as their vaults were used for coin storage and their notes and receipts became a convenient method of payment. 1660s, central banking. The world's oldest central bank, Sveriges Riksbank, was created in Sweden. Initially, the bank was forbidden to issue banknotes due to lessons learned from Stockholms Banko, Sweden's first bank. Stockholms Banko issued Europe's first banknotes, but got carried away and issued more than could be redeemed, a money creation technique known as fractional reserve banking. Stockholms Banko failed when banknote holders wanted the underlying metal coins back. In 1668, Sveriges Riksbank was founded, and later in 1701, it was allowed to issue banknotes, then called credit notes. It gained exclusivity over banknote printing 200 years later, in 1897, with the first Riksbank Act. See image 1.7 for a picture of the bank in the supplementary PDF. The Riksbank is noted for its attitude towards innovation. In July 2009, it was the first central bank to charge money from commercial banks to maintain overnight deposits, rather than paying interest, pushing the overnight deposit rate down to a negative 0.25% annualized. It deepened this interest rate, as well as other associated rates, in 2014 and 2015. This was an effort to stimulate the economy by encouraging the lending and spending of money rather than hoarding when quantitative easing was not having the desired effect. 1727. Overdrafts. The Royal Bank of Scotland was founded, introducing an overdraft facility where certain applicants were able to borrow money up to a certain limit and were charged interest only on the amount drawn, rather than on the full amount. This was a form of fintech. 1800 to 1860, cowrie depreciation. Here is a powerful example of how the supply of money causes price inflation. When cowrie shells were first introduced to Uganda around 1800, a woman could typically be bought for 2 shells. Over the next 60 years, as more shells were imported at scale, prices rose, and by 1860, a woman commanded a price of 1,000 shells. Rayi stones. No history of money would be complete without mentioning the Rayi, sometimes called Fayi, stones, still in use on the island of Yap. Yap is a small island in the Federated States of Micronesia, approximately 2,000 kilometers east of Manila, Philippines. It is known for its superb scuba diving and its Rayi stones. Rayi stones are large circular stone discs with holes in the middle to help transportation. They are made with stone quarried from Palau Island, about 400 kilometers away, brought back by canoe with some effort, and are still used as money today. John Thargan, historical preservation officer of Yap, in an interview with the BBC, explains the origin of the Rayi stones. Several hundred years ago, some people from Yap went on a fishing trip and got lost and arrived accidentally in Palau. They saw the limestone structures that occur naturally on that island and thought they looked great. They broke off a piece of stone and did a bit of carving on it with shell tools. They brought home a stone that was shaped like a whale, which is called Rayi in Yapese, and that is where the word comes from. Rayi stones come in all sorts of sizes, from a few hand spans to over 3 meters in diameter, and have a value mainly based on their history, but also on their size and finish. According to monetary economist J.P. Koning's excellent blog, Moneyness, W.H. Furness, who spent a year on the island, wrote in his 1910 book, The Island of Stone Money, Yap of the Carolines, a Rayi spanning a length of 3 hands and of good whiteness and shape ought to purchase 50 baskets of food. A basket is about 18 inches long and 10 inches deep, and the food is taro root, husked coconuts, yams, and bananas. Or it is worth an 80 or a 100-pound pig, or 1,000 coconuts, or a pearl shell measuring the length of the hand plus the width of 3 fingers up to the wrist. I exchanged a small, short-handled axe for a good white Rayi, 50 centimeters in diameter. For another Rayi, a little larger, I gave a 50-pound bag of rice. I was told that a well-finished Rayi, about 4 feet in diameter, is the price usually paid either to the parents or to the headman of the village as a compensation of the theft of a mispil, a woman. In terms of recording the ownership changes of these unwieldy pieces, Thongan comments, there's no problem in knowing who owns which piece because all the pieces next to a dwelling tend to belong to that house. All those which are found on dancing grounds, their ownership does shift from time to time, but the shift is always done publicly in front of chiefs or elders, so everyone remembers what belongs to whom. There was also the case of a large stone that was lost at sea, recorded by Furness, who heard the legend recounted by a local fortune teller and exorcist. The fortune teller told Furness that a few generations ago a large stone was lost at sea, and even though it is not physically present, and no one can see it, claims on the stone continue to have value. This particular Rayi stone is used by some economists as an example of fiat money existing in primitive societies. However, Dror Goldberg argues in a 2005 paper, Famous Myths of Fiat Money, that this is not fiat. There is no evidence of this stone being used in trade, as ownership remained in the family, and the value of the lost stone was agreed by the community, not by any legal decree. Goldberg argues that Rayi stones have legal, historical, religious, aesthetic, and sentimental value, and are therefore not fiat. And furthermore, there are no good examples of fiat money existing in primitive societies. 1913, birth of the U.S. Federal Reserve System. In 1913, the Federal Reserve Act was passed into law in the USA. This created the Federal Reserve System, the central banking system of the USA. The act was drafted by influential commercial bankers and gave the central bank the monopoly on the price and quantity of money, and had the mandate to maximize employment and ensure price stability. The system has public and private sector components, and the regional Federal Reserve banks are owned by large U.S. private banks. The Federal Reserve is discussed in greater detail in the appendix. The U.S. dollar remained on a gold standard for a period of time under the Federal Reserve system, as we will see in the section about gold standards. 1999, the euro. On the 1st of January 1999, the euro officially became the currency of the member states of the European Union: Belgium, Germany, Spain, France, Ireland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Austria, Portugal, and Finland. Euro notes and coins came into circulation in 2002. The currency is now the official currency of 19 of the current 28 EU states, 6 non-EU jurisdictions, and a number of other non-sovereign entities. 2009, Bitcoin. On the 3rd of January 2009, the first Bitcoin was brought, or mined, into existence. How does Bitcoin relate to money? We'll discuss Bitcoin in a lot more depth later on, but it was first commonly described as a cryptocurrency. And simply because of the word currency, people started thinking, is it money? Does it fulfill the traditional three functions of money? What is money anyway? Does Bitcoin count? Defining Bitcoin is a popular activity for regulators and policymakers who need to determine if Bitcoins fall under their purview or not. I suspect things would have worked out differently had Bitcoin been originally described as a crypto commodity or a crypto asset. It turns out that Bitcoin is hard to shoehorn into existing categories, so perhaps it, along with other crypto things, belongs in a new asset class. The fact is, for our purposes, the definition of Bitcoin doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you define money. It doesn't matter if Bitcoin fits the bill or not. Bitcoin has some properties that make it appear from one angle, like money, and from another angle, like a commodity, such as gold. Money is in the eye of the beholder. Nowadays, we have so many different forms of money, all with slightly different characteristics and trade-offs, that Bitcoin and its siblings can and will sit alongside the other forms. Good enough money. I like to use the concept of good enough money. If the money you want to use is good enough for your purposes, then it is okay. For example, when I borrow cash from my colleagues to buy my lunch, sometimes I pay them back in Grab credits. Grab is a ride-hailing app similar to Uber, but localized for Asia. And it also has a wallet function which you top up with your credit or debit card. The credits are denominated in local currency and can be used to pay for journeys, sent to other users, or used to pay for goods in some shops. Some of my colleagues use Grab for their taxis, so paying them back in Grab credits is fine for me and fine for them. So, Grab credits are good enough money, so far as we are concerned, for that particular small denomination use. But I wouldn't buy a house with Grab credits, nor would a company settle a large invoice with it. It wouldn't be good enough money in those situations. It seems that people and companies will accept a wide range of forms of money so long as they can do the next thing with it, whether that is paying for a taxi, settling invoices, or saving it for long-term value appreciation. Gold standards. Some people talk about the gold standard. In fact, there is no such thing as the gold standard. There are a few types of gold standard. 1. Gold specie standard. Coins are made of gold and are a certain weight and purity and convenient standard units instead of random shapes, sizes, and weights. This is called a gold specie standard. Specie is a Latin word for the actual form. This is commodity money. 2. Gold bullion standard. Notes, bits of paper, are redeemable or convertible at the issuer, usually the central bank, for gold, usually in the form of gold bullion. This means bars of gold of certain standard weights and purities. This is called a gold bullion standard. This is representative money. And 3. Non-convertible gold bullion standard. This is where the issuer declares that their currency is worth a certain amount of gold, but doesn't allow you to redeem your money for gold. This is starting to blur the lines between representative and fiat money. When people talk about the gold standard, they usually mean a gold bullion standard where a note represents some defined amount of gold and can be redeemed for it. The issuer of the currency, usually a central bank, pegs their currency to a fixed weight in pure or fine gold and tells the world that they will exchange one unit of currency for a certain amount of gold stored in their vaults. This is a currency peg, which we discussed earlier, and means they need to have the gold in their vaults in order to remain credible and promise to let people redeem their notes for gold. The amount of gold you have in your vaults is largely irrelevant if you don't let people redeem their notes. When a few countries adopt a gold standard, the exchange rates between their respective currencies become effectively pegged. In theory, you could always sell one currency for gold and then buy a known amount of another gold standard currency with it. So the gold peg rates also determine the currency-to-currency exchange rates. Before the First World War, the effective exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the pound sterling was $4.8665 to £1, because both currencies were on a gold standard. Of course, there were costs and risks involved in the transactions and the storage and transport of the gold, so that's why it is an effective peg with some wiggle room rather than an absolute peg. Before we look at an example of a gold standard, let's clear up some terminology. Gold and silver are measured by weight, or mass, to be pedantic. The units are grains and troy ounces. There are 480 grains to 1 troy ounce, and 12 troy ounces to 1 troy pound. In standard terms, this means 1 troy ounce is 31.10 grams, which is about 10% heavier than 1 normal or avoirdupois ounce of 28.35 grams. Old habits die hard. The troy ounce is still the measure used today when pricing gold or other precious metals. See image 1.9 in the supplementary PDF. Gold standards in the USA. Although many countries have attempted to peg their currencies to gold, the USA has had an interesting history. According to Brief History of the Gold Standard in the United States, published by the Congressional Research Service, the USA went through a number of periods with multiple attempts at pegging the US dollar to gold. They all eventually failed. Let's look at what happened. 1792 to 1834, bimetallic specie standard. Standardized gold coins, $10 eagles and $2.50 quarter eagles, and silver coins existed, minted by the government. The definition of $1 was based on a certain weight of silver or a certain weight of gold, which valued the metals in the ratio of 15 to 1. World markets valued gold a little more than implied by the USA's peg, so gold coins left the USA, leaving the USA mainly using silver coins. 1834 to 1862, silver flees the USA. The USA changed their ratio to 16 to 1 by minting the gold coins with slightly less gold. World markets now liked silver a little more than implied by this new ratio. Thus, the silver coins left the USA, leaving the USA mainly using the new, less goldy gold coins. It is hard to peg things that trade in markets abroad. 1862. Civil War chaos and fiat paper money. The USA government issued notes called greenbacks. Greenbacks were notes that were declared as legal tender, but were not convertible into gold or silver. This took the USA off any metallic standard and onto fiat paper money. The dollar lost value in the marketplace, and people preferred to hold 23.22 grains of gold more than $1. 1879 to 1933, a true gold standard. A dollar was redefined in terms of the pre-war weight of gold, but not silver, at $20.67 per troy ounce. The Treasury issued gold coins and convertible, meaning redeemable, gold notes, and greenbacks were once again redeemable in gold. The Federal Reserve System was created in 1913. Allow me to digress just for a bit of fun. This was a difficult political period that coincided with the birth of populism in the U.S. Indeed, L. Frank Baum's book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, is regarded by some as a clever political satire, a parable on populism, and a commentary on monetary policy. References are numerous. Yellow brick road? Gold. Ruby slippers? In the book, they were silver, and a reference to a populist demand for free and unlimited coinage of silver and gold at the 16-to-1 ratio. Scarecrow? Farmers, who weren't as dim as first thought. Tin Man? Industrial workers. Blind monkeys? Plains Indians. The Cowardly Lion? William Jennings Bryan, Nebraska representative in Congress and later the Democratic presidential candidate. Emerald City, where the wizard lives? Washington, D.C. The wizard, an old man whose power is achieved through acts of deception? Well, pick any politician in Washington. Now, can you guess what Oz is a reference to? Yes, the unit for precious metals. Those parallels are discussed in more detail by Quentin P. Taylor, professor of history, Rogers State College, in a fascinating essay, Money and Politics in the Land of Oz, 1934 to 1973, the New Deal and the End of the True Gold Standard. The 1934 Gold Reserve Act devalued the dollar from $20.67 to $35 per troy ounce and ended convertibility for citizens. The free circulation of gold coins is unnecessary, President Franklin Roosevelt told Congress, insisting that the transfer of gold is essential only for the payment of international trade balances. The Gold Reserve Act outlawed most private possession of gold, forcing individuals to sell it to the Treasury. Those found hoarding gold in coin or bullion could be punished by a fine of up to $10,000 and/or jail time. According to Wikipedia, a year earlier in 1933, Executive Order 6102 had made it a criminal offense for U.S. citizens to own or trade gold anywhere in the world, with exceptions for some jewelry and collector's coins. These prohibitions were relaxed starting in 1964. Gold certificates were again allowed for private investors on April 24, 1964, although the obligation to pay the certificate holder on demand in gold specie would not be honored. By 1975, Americans could again freely own and trade gold. This quasi-gold standard was maintained under the Bretton Woods International Monetary Agreement of 1944. The Bretton Woods Agreement is explained in greater detail later. 1971. The Nixon administration stopped freely converting dollars at their official exchange rate of $35 per troy ounce. This effectively ended the Bretton Woods Agreement. 1972. The dollar was devalued from $35 to $38 per troy ounce. 1973, the dollar was devalued from $38 to $42.22 per troy ounce. 1974, President Gerald Ford permitted private gold ownership again in the USA. And 1976, the gold standard was abandoned in the USA. The US dollar became pure fiat money. So people talk about the gold standard, but let's be realistic. It is not really a gold standard if, A, people can't redeem their dollars for gold, and B, you keep changing the rate. It turns out that implementing a gold standard is difficult, even if you can put people into prison for owning gold. Fiat currency and intrinsic value. Yes, but Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, is a comment I hear a lot from people trying to understand why Bitcoin has a price. However, it is not a very good argument against Bitcoin. Fiat currencies, the US dollar, the British pound, the euro, etc., have no intrinsic value either. In fact, fiat currencies are defined by not having intrinsic value. That is worth repeating. Fiat currency has no intrinsic value. But that is okay. On the European Central Bank's, the ECB, website, you can read, Euro banknotes and coins are money, but so is the balance on a bank account. What actually is money? How is it created? And what is the ECB's role? The changing essence of money. The nature of money has evolved over time. Early money was usually commodity money, an object made of something that had a market value, such as a gold coin. Later on, representative money consisted of banknotes that could be swapped against a certain amount of gold or silver. Modern economies, including the euro area, are based on fiat money. This is money that is declared legal tender and is issued by a central bank, but, unlike representative money, cannot be converted into, for example, a fixed weight of gold. It has no intrinsic value. The paper used for banknotes is, in principle, worthless, yet is still accepted in exchange for goods and services because people trust the central bank to keep the value of money stable over time. If central banks were to fail in this endeavor, fiat money would lose its general acceptability as a medium of exchange and its attractiveness as a store of value. The St. Louis Fed, in episode 9 of a podcast series called Functions of Money, the Economic Lowdown podcast series, says, Fiat money is money that does not have intrinsic value and does not represent an asset in a vault somewhere. Its value comes from being declared legal tender, an acceptable form of payment, by the government of the issuing country. So, next time someone brings up intrinsic value, try to be patient and explain that intrinsic value doesn't really matter. What matters is if there is utility in the asset. How useful is it? Well, fiat currency is useful, at the very least because it is the settlement instrument with which you pay your taxes to the state, and more broadly because it is legal tender and must be accepted by merchants. If you don't pay your taxes, you go to prison, or worse. So some people argue that fiat currency is backed by the threat of state violence. Other people say that fiat currency is backed by the trust and confidence in state institutions, which is a little bit vague, don't you think? But at least it sort of makes sense, unlike the cryptocurrency favorite. Bitcoin is backed by math, which is entirely nonsensical. Although at first it sounds kind of profound, don't stop to think about what that means. Mathematics is used to determine which transactions are valid or not, and is used to control the speed at which bitcoins are created, but this is not a backing, in the sense that a bond is backed by the issuing company, or a US dollar is backed by the assets on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, or a startup is backed by a venture capitalist. Legal tender. When a currency is declared legal tender, it means that by statute, or law, people must accept it as a settlement mechanism to meet a financial obligation, and that you can pay your tax bills with it. Not all notes and coins are legal tender in all circumstances. Currencies are, in general, not legal tender outside of their home jurisdiction. For example, someone in the UK can refuse to accept Russian rubles as repayment of a debt. This doesn't stop a recipient accepting rubles if they want. It just stops someone being able to force a recipient to accept them. Also, in many countries, you can't force a recipient to accept payment in an antisocial amount of loose change. There are specific rules as to what counts as legal tender. In Singapore, according to the 2002 Currency Act, you can't force someone to accept more than $2 in any combination of 5, 10, or 20 cent coins, and you can't force someone to accept more than $10 in 50 cent coins. Currently, there are no limits for payment in $1 coins, but after a series of high-profile incidents in 2014, where people and merchants made payments in large amounts of loose change, the Currency Act is being reconsidered to a more memorable uniform legal tender limit of 10 coins per denomination across all denominations per transaction. This means that a pair would legally be able to use up to 10 pieces each of 5 cent, 10 cent, 20 cent, 50 cent, and $1 coins, but no more per transaction. Also in Singapore, under the 1967 Currency Interchangeability Agreement, the Brunei dollar is acceptable as customary tender on a one-to-one basis. You can pay for a coffee in Singapore by handing over the same amount in Brunei dollars. Banks in each country will accept the other currency at par. Zimbabwe uses U.S. dollars as the main currency for pricing goods and for government transaction, but lists the following currencies as legal tender: Euro, United States dollar, pound sterling, South African rand, Botswana pula, Australian dollar, Chinese yuan, and Japanese yen. Its own currency, the Zimbabwe dollar, is not on that list. There are also multiple versions of the Zimbabwe dollar with different pricing, and the country is a fascinating case study for how not to do currency. It is a mess for shopkeepers, but a delight from monetary economists. Currency pegs. A currency peg is when someone in charge declares that one currency is worth a fixed amount of another currency and then attempts to maintain that exchange rate by matching the supply of either currency with the demand. If people think that you have got your peg wrong, a black market can emerge where people trade the currencies at what they perceive to be a more accurate exchange rate. How do you maintain a peg? Firstly, you threaten. You announce the pegged rate and then declare penalties for people found deviating from it. This may mean fines, prison, or perhaps something worse. But you also need to be credible and try to prevent black markets from emerging. Credibility comes from having enough of both currencies to match whatever a trader might want to exchange. For example, let's say you are the king of a country and you declare a peg of one apple equals one orange. If one year, for whatever reason, people really want apples, the demand for apples will exceed the demand for oranges. So people might be prepared to pay two oranges for one apple. But you've declared a peg, so everyone will come to you with the oranges that they don't want and demand one apple for each orange they bring you. So to keep the peg, you better have a lot of apples to give out. If you don't have them, then a black market will emerge that excludes you, and people will start trading one apple for more than one orange, making a mockery of your peg. So, you need to have at least as many apples in reserve as there are oranges in circulation. And vice versa. If, on the other hand, people really want oranges, you're going to need a lot of oranges to hand out, and you'll be receiving apples, which no one wants, in return. So, to maintain a peg to the very end, you need as many apples in reserve as there are oranges in circulation, and you need as many oranges in reserve as there are apples in circulation. Or in the fiat world, you need to back your fiat currency 100% with the currency you are pegged to, at the peg rate, an arrangement known as a currency board. While central banks can prevent their currencies from going up in value by creating as much fiat currency as they want, and therefore capping the value of their currency, it's harder for them to prevent their currencies from going down in value, because they need other currencies with which to buy their own currency back in order to prop its price up. This is essentially How George Soros Broke the Bank of England. He had more ammo than the bank. George Soros and the Bank of England. Rohindar details the story on priceeconomics.com. In October 1990, the Bank of England joined the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, or ERM, and committed to keep the exchange rate of Deutsche Marks and pounds sterling to between 2.78 and 3.13 marks per pound. By 1992, it had become obvious to the market that sterling was valued too highly, even at the floor of 2.78 marks per pound, and the real price of sterling should have been lower. In the months leading up to September 1992, Soros, via his quantum hedge fund, borrowed pounds from anyone he could and sold them to anyone who would buy them, borrowing something to sell it with an intention to buy it back later at a lower price is known as going short. According to an article in The Atlantic, Soros built up a short position of $1.5 billion worth of pounds. On the night of Tuesday, the 15th of September, the fund accelerated its bet and sold more, extending the fund's short position from $1.5 billion worth to $10 billion worth, and pushing the price of sterling lower and lower overnight, while the Bank of England was absent from the markets. The following morning, the Bank of England had to buy sterling in order to prop up the value of the pound and maintain the peg they committed to. But what can the Bank of England buy pounds with? Their reserves, other currencies, or borrowed money. The Bank of England announced that they would borrow up to $15 billion in order to buy pounds, and Soros was prepared to sell that amount to neutralize the demand created by the Bank of England. It was a game of brinkmanship. So the bank bought 1 billion pounds of sterling over several batches and raised short-term interest rates by 2 percentage points to make Soros' loans expensive. Remember, Soros was borrowing sterling in order to sell it and had to pay interest on the pounds he was borrowing. But it was too late. The markets didn't react, and the price of sterling didn't rise. At 7:30 p.m. that evening, the Bank of England was forced to exit from the ERM and let sterling float. Over the next month, the price of sterling fell from 2.78 marks to 2.40 marks per pound. That critical Wednesday was known as Black Wednesday, and Soros became known as the man who broke the Bank of England. Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods meeting was all about currency pegs. On the 1st of July 1944, during World War II, delegates from 44 countries met in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, USA, for 21 days of discussion to normalize commercial and financial relations. The outcome was a kind of international gold standard agreement where the U.S. dollar was pegged to gold at $35 per troy ounce, and other currencies were pegged to the dollar, with 1% wiggle room, and could be redeemed for gold at the U.S. Treasury. The International Monetary Fund was established, as was the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the IBRD, which would eventually become part of the World Bank. At that time, ordinary Americans were still banned from owning non-jewelry gold. Prior to this, in 1931, Britain, most of the Commonwealth, except Canada, and many other countries had abandoned the gold standard. Bretton Woods, therefore, marked a return to some kind of gold standard. The Bretton Woods Agreement didn't work very well. Countries frequently devalued their currencies with respect to the dollar and gold. For example, in 1949, Britain devalued the pound by about 30%. From $4.30 to $2.80, and many other countries followed suit. In 1971, the Bretton Woods Agreement broke down after the U.S. stopped honoring the convertibility of dollars to gold. This coincided with a big drop in U.S. gold reserves and increase in foreign claims on U.S. dollars. Quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, or QE, often comes up in conversations about fiat currencies, and people describe it as printing money, But it's not that simple. QE is a euphemism for an issuing authority, generally a central bank, increasing the amount of fiat money in circulation in order to stimulate a flagging economy. So people worry that this additional money dilutes the value of existing money, and this makes people worry about the sustainability of the fiat system. Printing money is a poor description for QE. Think about it. If the central bank really printed money, whether physically or digitally, who would it give it to, and how? So, how does QE work? The central bank buys assets, usually bonds, from the private sector, commercial banks, asset managers, hedge funds, etc., in the secondary market. These are bonds that have already been issued and are now traded by financial market participants. Central banks broadly think of the private sector as having a balance of two things, money and non-money, meaning other financial assets. And central banks can, to some extent, control that balance by buying financial assets from the private sector to add money, or by selling financial assets to the private sector to remove money. Why bonds? Because we take comfort that our central banks only own safe assets, and bonds are generally regarded as safe, or at least safer, than other financial instruments. Their value is also affected by interest rates, something that a central bank has some degree of control over. Who can central banks buy bonds from? Certainly not you or me directly, because we don't have that kind of relationship with central banks. As we will see in the next section, central banks have financial relationships with certain commercial banks called clearing banks, who have accounts called reserve accounts with the central bank. So, central banks buy bonds from clearing banks, and they pay by crediting the bank's reserve account with new money. Clearing banks can also act as an agent for other bondholders who wish to sell bonds to the central bank through the clearing banks. Central banks start the QE journey by buying government bonds, U.S. treasuries, etc., because they are considered the least risky bonds. When they run out of those to buy, they then move to more risky bonds, such as those issued by corporations. The problem is that the central bank ends up with a bunch of risky bonds on its balance sheet. And remember that, from a balance sheet perspective, it is the bonds that back the currency. There are two worries with QE. One, with excessive QE, the value of money will go down as there is more of it sloshing around in the private sector, which is not great for savers, and could also cause price inflation, though we haven't seen this yet. And two, a central bank owns risky financial assets that could go down in value, damaging the central bank's balance sheet when the value of the assets it owns falls. We can see the impact that QE has had on central bank balance sheets since the most recent global financial crisis. See chart number 1, recent growth in central bank balance sheets in image 1.11 in the supplementary PDF. Summary. The history of money is characterized by its failures. Inflation, dilution, debasement, clipping, recoining, and creation of new tokens worth less and less all appear frequently. The theme with money seems to be that whatever form it takes, it gets watered down either through debasement or by excessive creation until a certain limit, then there is a reform. The rate of monetary debasement seems to have increased, and the latest experiment in debasing is that of QE. Currency pegs are difficult to manage unless backed 100% with reserves, and although they can be successful for some time, they mostly, eventually, fail. Is fiat currency the best solution to money? Will fiat money, backed by the full faith and confidence that people have in today's governments, continue to survive? Who knows? Some believe that we have some new challengers in the form of cryptocurrencies. The narrative from policymakers has shifted from ignoring cryptocurrencies, to stating that they are not a threat to economic stability, to discussing a potential threat. A chapter in the BIS Annual Economic Report published by the Bank of International Settlements in June 2018 reads, "A third longer-term challenge concerns the stability of the financial system. It remains to be seen whether widespread use of cryptocurrencies and related self-executing financial products will give rise to new financial vulnerabilities and systemic risks. Close monitoring of developments will be required." Although we have arguably better tools and technology now than at any previous point in time, humans are still humans, and will still do what they can to gain and hold on to power and wealth, often making the same mistakes as their predecessors. Part 2. Digital Money. It is worth understanding how digital money is currently used to settle debts. In my career, I have spent time with people with a wide range of experience, from new graduates through to seasoned professionals who wear ties and work in banks and management consultancies, yet I rarely come across people who really understand how a payment is made and who can articulate clearly how money moves around the financial system. How are interbank payments made? Banks need to pay each other all the time, sometimes because a customer has instructed the bank to make a payment on their behalf, sometimes because a bank needs to pay another bank as a result of its own trading or lending activity. Here we are going to look at the bank-to-bank payments that arise when a customer wishes to make a payment to someone else who banks elsewhere. We easily understand physical payments that are made directly when you pay in cash for something without a third-party intermediary. This can be described as peer-to-peer, as you simply hand over cash to the other person. There's no one in the middle. You don't need to instruct or pay a third party, and no one can stop the payment. The cash payment is also resistant to censorship. If you are the recipient, you can be reasonably confident, upon inspection, that the banknote or coins are unique, that is, not counterfeit copies. Otherwise, you should not accept them, and there is no transaction. It is also obvious that the payer hasn't spent that same cash already, else they wouldn't have it to give to you. And furthermore, they can't use the same cash to simultaneously pay you and someone else, because physical cash can't exist in two places at once. Of course, this is all intuitive. As soon as you move into the digital world, things become a little more complex. Digital assets are easy to copy. Unlike physical cash, you can't give a digital asset, for example, a file, to someone as a currency payment. Well, you can, but they won't value it because they can't tell if it is unique. They can't be sure that you will delete it once you have sent it to them. And they can't tell if you have sent or will send a copy of the file to a different person. This problem with digital assets is called the double spend problem. Wikipedia describes double spending as a potential flaw in a digital cash scheme in which the same single-digit token can be sent more than once. This is possible because a digital token consists of a digital file that can be duplicated or falsified. The digital money world deals with this by using a bookkeeper, who is an independent third party, who, because they are regulated, can be trusted to maintain accurate books and records and abide by certain rules. For example, you trust that PayPal is not creating PayPal dollars out of thin air because each PayPal balance must be backed by an equivalent balance in its bank. And you trust that the regulators will do their job and shut PayPal down if they are not behaving. You also trust that when you instruct your bank to make a payment, the amount of money leaving your account is the same as the amount that is entering the recipient's account. Less fees, of course. So, with any form of digital asset, you need a trusted bookkeeper to maintain a list of who owns what and who plays by some well-understood and trusted rules. They often have a license from an authority that gives them some credibility, and increases your confidence that they are carrying out their activities according to certain standards. Now, let's dive into how the movement of bits and bytes and debits and credits produces the effect of money moving instantly from one person to another. How are payments made? How does digital money move from one bank account to another? When Alice wants to pay $10 to Bob, does Alice's bank simply subtract $10 from her account and tell Bob's bank to add that $10 to Bob's account? And then how do the banks settle that $10 up between them? It can be complex. Let's build this up by looking at the following scenarios. 1. Same bank. 2. Different banks. 3. Cross-border with the same currency. And 4. Foreign exchange. Same bank. If Alice is trying to pay $10 to Bob and they both have accounts at the same bank, it's relatively straightforward. Alice instructs her bank to make the payment, and the bank then adjusts their records by subtracting $10 from Alice's account and adding $10 to Bob's account. In banking jargon, some banks call this a book transfer, as it is just a transfer from one account to another and no money moves into or out of the bank. If you imagine a bank as managing a giant spreadsheet with a list of account holders in the first column and a list of balances in another column, the bank subtracts 10 from Alice's row and adds 10 to Bob's row. I refer to this book transfer as a minus 10 plus 10 transaction. Because this accounting entry has been entirely internal to the bank, we can say that the transaction settles across the bank's books, or is cleared by the bank. It's important to understand that the money in customer accounts is a liability of the banks. When you log into your online banking and see $100 in your account, this means the bank owes you $100 and should either pay you that money on demand via a cashier or cash machine, or they need to pay someone else, a coffee shop, a supermarket, or your friend, when you instruct and authorize them to do so. So while from your point of view, the money in your account is an asset, from the bank's point of view, the money in your account is an outstanding liability. So the transaction on the bank's balance sheet, where assets and liabilities are recorded, looks more like this. Please see the balance sheet in image 2.1 in the supplementary PDF. Although we don't touch the asset side of the balance sheet for transfers between customers of the same bank, we will need it later. Different banks. Now consider when Alice wants to pay $10 to Bob, but they bank at different banks, albeit in the same country and currency. Alice instructs her bank, Bank A, to remove $10 from her account and pay it to Bob's account at Bank B. In banking jargon, Alice is the payer and Bob is the beneficiary. So Bank A reduces Alice's balance and Bank B increases Bob's balance. The problem. While the customers are happy, can you see the problem from the perspective of the banks? Bank A now owes Alice $10 less than before, so it is better off, but Bank B now owes Bob $10 more, and so is worse off. So that can't be the whole picture. Bank B would be furious. The solution. This payment instruction must be balanced by a bank-to-bank transfer. Bank A needs to pay Bank B $10 to balance out the customer account movements and complete the end-to-end payment. How does an interbank payment happen? Bank A could put a bunch of banknotes in a van and send them to Bank B. This would make both banks square. Bank A owes Alice $10 less, but pays $10 in banknotes to Bank B. And Bank B owes Bob $10 more, but receives $10 in banknotes from Bank A. But in most countries, when banks want to transfer money to each other, they don't put bundles of banknotes in vans. They pay each other digitally. The digital solutions. There are two main ways a bank can digitally pay another bank: by using correspondent bank accounts, or by using a central bank payment system. Correspondent bank accounts. If you set up a new business, the first thing you would want to do is open a bank account to let you receive and make payments. Banks are no different. If you set up a new bank, you still need bank accounts in order to participate in digital payments. Correspondent bank accounts are industry jargon for the bank accounts that banks open with other banks. These are also called nostros. Nostro is a Latin word meaning our, as in our account. Correspondent banking describes activities related to the use of these accounts. In your new bank's balance sheet, the deposits you hold in your nostros would appear as assets, in the same way as you, as an individual, consider the deposits you hold in your bank to be your assets. The bank that you opened the account with, your correspondent bank, shows those funds as their liability in the same way as your own consumer bank regards your individual deposits as its liability. If you Google for your bank's name and correspondent banks, you might find a list of accounts where they hold their foreign currency. Here is an example from the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, the CBA. See image 2.1 in the supplementary PDF. You can see that CBA has opened a US dollar account at the Bank of New York Mellon and a euro account at Societe Generale. The SWIFT codes are identifiers for those specific banks. So, back to our example. If Bank A had an account at Bank B, it could instruct Bank B to transfer the $10 from its account to Bob's account. In this way, the banks are neatly squared off. Bank A owes Alice $10 less, but has $10 less in its account with Bank B. And Bank B owes Bob $10 more, but owes Bank A $10 less. The problem with correspondent bank accounts. Although correspondent bank accounts allow payments to flow, they can also present difficulties for the banks themselves. Imagine running a bank and having to maintain accounts at every single other bank that your customers might want to transfer money to. You'd need to open accounts at every single bank in the world, just in case you have a customer who wants to transfer to someone who banks there. This would be an operational nightmare. The chorus.